Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now.
There were five or six of them. They were just walking and just shooting like this. They did not shoot upwards. They did not scream. They did not say, everyone lay down, we will kill you, and etc. They were just walking and gunning down everyone methodically in silence.
ISIS-K claims responsibility for Friday's attack on a Russian concert hall that killed at least 137 people. We'll look at how Putin is responding with New School professor Nina Khrushcheva and The New Yorker's Moscow correspondent Joshua Yaffa. Then to Gaza.
Up to 16% of children under 5 in northern Gaza are now malnourished, compared with less than 1% before the conflict began. Virtually all households are already skipping meals every day, and adults are reducing their meals so children can eat.
We'll speak with the World Peace Foundation's Alex Dvall, who says we're about to witness in Gaza the most intense famine since the Second World War. We'll also speak with him about the catastrophic hunger crisis looming in Sudan.
By all measures, the sheer scale of humanitarian needs, the numbers of people displaced and facing hunger, Sudan is one of the worst humanitarian disasters in recent memory.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Russia, the death toll's risen to 137 from an attack on a popular concert hall in Moscow on Friday. Authorities say gunmen opened fire inside a sold-out rock concert, then set the venue ablaze, the Crocus City Hall. More than 100 people were also injured, many in critical condition. Authorities in Russia have detained 11 people, including four men from Tajikistan who appeared in court today. They all appeared to have been badly beaten, possibly during interrogations. One suspect, who was in a wheelchair, seemed to lose consciousness during the court session. Reuters reports he may have had an eye missing. An affiliate of the Islamic State, ISIS-K, has claimed responsibility and posted video of the attack. Russian authorities have suggested Ukraine was involved in the attack, a claim strongly denied by Kyiv. We'll have more on the story after headlines with Professor Nina Khrushcheva and The New Yorker magazine's Joshua Yaffa. Horrifying accounts continue to come from Gaza City, where Israel's raid on Al-Shifa Hospital has entered a second week. Israeli forces have killed at least 170 people at the hospital and detained another 400. Survivors of the raid have told Al Jazeera Israeli tanks and armored bulldozers have driven over bodies and ambulances. Israeli forces are also attacking two other hospitals in Gaza. Meanwhile, the head of the UN Palestinian Aid Agency, UNRWA, says Israel's now denying access to all UNRWA food convoys to northern Gaza, even though the region is on the brink of famine. On Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres traveled to the Rafah border crossing.
A long line of blocked relief trucks on one side of the gates, the long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage.
Over the weekend, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris warned against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu invading Rafah. She spoke to Rachel Scott of ABC News.
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake.
A mistake, but would there be consequences if he does move forward?
Well, we're going to take it one step at a time, but we've been very clear in terms of our perspective on whether or not that should happen.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
This comes as Israel continues to carry out attacks across Gaza, where the death toll has topped 32,200. This is a Palestinian man named Yunus Qassab in Rafah.
Israel does not want a ceasefire. Instead, it wants to continue exterminating the Palestinian people. This is what Israel and America are planning simultaneously. They do not want a ceasefire. Israel seeks genocide against the Palestinian people, and particularly the Gaza Strip, and this is a crime.
At the United Nations Security Council, China and Russia Friday vetoed a Gaza ceasefire resolution drafted by the United States. China's ambassador to the UN, Zhang Jun, criticized the text because it did not actually demand a ceasefire.
The final text remains ambiguous and does not call for an immediate ceasefire, nor does it even provide an answer to the question of realizing a ceasefire in a short time. This is a clear deviation from the consensus of the council members and fell far short of the expectations of the international community. An immediate ceasefire is a fundamental prerequisite for saving lives, expanding humanitarian access, and preventing greater conflicts.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, criticized Russia and China for vetoing the resolution.
So let's be honest. For all the fiery rhetoric, we all know that Russia and China are not doing anything diplomatically to advance a lasting peace or to meaningfully contribute to the humanitarian response effort.
President Biden signed a $1.2 trillion spending package to keep the federal government open until October. The Senate approved the appropriations bill 74-24. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders voted no because the bill stripped funding to UNRWA for the next year.
Tens of thousands of people are starving. UNRWA is trying to feed them. And the Israeli government and its allies like AIPAC spend much of their time lobbying to defund UNRWA, the major organization which is feeding starving people. Sadly, tragically, many members of Congress seem to be happy to be part of this starvation caucus.
In the House, the spending bill was approved 286-134. New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who voted no, accused Israel of committing genocide during a speech on the House floor.
If you want to know what an unfolding genocide looks like, open your eyes. It looks like the forced famine of 1.1 million innocents. It looks like thousands of children eating grass as their bodies consume themselves while trucks of food are slowed and halted just miles away. It looks like good and decent people who do nothing or too little, too late. It is against United States law to provide weapons to forces who block United States humanitarian assistance. And that is exactly what is happening right now.
Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is in Washington, D.C. for meetings with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and others. Axios is reporting Gallant is coming with a, quote, long list of U.S. weapons Israel wants to receive in an expedited manner. Protests continued around the world this weekend. In Ireland, tens of thousands marched in Dublin to demand a ceasefire and freedom for Palestinians. In Chile, members of the Palestinian community, which is believed to be the largest Palestinian community outside of the Arab world, gathered with allies to call on President Gabriel Boric to break off all diplomatic relations with Israel.
We stand with the oppressed and against the oppressors. We are here to say no more crimes against humanity, so we protest. No more relations with the criminal state of Israel, which insults our nation.
Here in New York, hundreds of activists gathered outside the Metropolitan Museum of Art to demand the prestigious museum and its board members cut ties with companies that benefit from Israel's assault on Gaza and commit to helping, quote, preserve Palestinian cultural heritage sites being destroyed by Israel, unquote. Activists displayed a massive 30 by 50 foot quilt on the steps of the Met, modeled after the AIDS Memorial quilt. The Palestine quilt pieced together works by 64 global artists on the theme of, quote, from oppression to liberation, free Palestine, unquote. In Senegal, early results from Sunday's presidential election put the opposition candidate Bassirou Diomaye Faye in the lead. At least five of the 18 other candidates already conceded to Faye, who's backed by the popular opposition figure Ousmane Sonko, who himself is barred from running. But former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, who has the backing of outgoing President Macky Sall, said he expects the vote could head to a runoff. A final provisional vote tally is expected Tuesday. Supporters of Sonko and Faye took to the streets to celebrate nonetheless.
I say it's great because it's democracy that's winning. Everyone thought it would never happen. Today, if these results are indeed confirmed, it's Senegal that absolutely wins.
Sunday's vote had been rescheduled after President Sall sought to delay the election, leading to large protests and accusations of an attempted power grab. Sonko and Faye were released from prison just days before the election, after Sall granted the men amnesty. Residents of Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, are facing rolling blackouts as Russia continues a wave of strikes against Ukraine's energy infrastructure. On Sunday, Russia hit an underground oil gas storage site. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces are continuing to attack Russian oil refineries despite a warning not to do so from the United States. The Financial Times reports the Biden administration fears the attacks inside Russia could drive up oil prices and provoke retaliation. Ukraine also hit two more Russian ships and a communication center used by Russia's Black Sea Fleet. In Nigeria, at least 130 kidnapped school children from the northwestern state of Kaduna were rescued Sunday after more than 2 weeks in captivity. Previous reports had put the total number of students closer to 300, but officials said the total was actually 137. On Friday, the Nigerian army rescued 17 students kidnapped in the far northwestern Sokoto. At least 1,400 students have been abducted since 2014, with armed groups demanding ransoms for their safe return. In Brazil, police arrested two politicians and Rio de Janeiro's former police chief in a major breakthrough for the investigation into the 2018 assassination of Marielle Franco, an outspoken Rio councilwoman and activist. Investigators say brothers Chiquinho Brijão and Domingos Brijão, who also both once served on Rio de Janeiro City Council and remain in official positions, are suspected of masterminding the assassination, which also killed Franco's driver, Anderson Pedro Gomes. Former Rio police chief Rivaldo Barbosa is accused of obstructing investigations into the fatal shooting. Marielle Franco had fought against police brutality and became a voice for other LGBTQ and Black Brazilians who face discrimination. Her longtime partner, Monica Benicio, spoke Sunday following news of the arrests.
Today is without a doubt an important day for democracy in Brazil. It is the beginning of a new struggle. We want everyone to be held responsible and everyone to be identified so that we can finally have justice for Marielle and Anderson.
New York Attorney General Letitia James could begin seizing some of former President Donald Trump's assets today if he fails to meet a deadline to post a $454 million bond after losing a civil fraud case in New York. Last week, Trump's attorney said the former president faces, quote, insurmountable difficulties in securing the bond after more than 30 companies refused to help him. Trump's attorneys have appealed the ruling, but a decision is not expected before today's deadline. This comes as Trump appears poised to make as much as $3 billion as the parent company of his social media platform, Truth Social, becomes a publicly traded firm following a merger last week. Meanwhile, Trump's expected back in court today in New York for a pretrial hearing in his hush money case. And in news from Capitol Hill, Republican Congressmember Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin has announced he will resign on April 19th. His seat will remain vacant until November. This will cut the House Republican majority to a one-vote margin. In other House news, Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion Friday to remove House Speaker Mike Johnson just 5 months after he took the office after the ouster of Kevin McCarthy. In other political news, New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy has dropped out of the Democratic primary race for Robert Menendez's Senate seat, clearing the way for Congressmember Andy Kim and others in the Democratic primary. Menendez, who is facing multiple corruption charges, has announced he won't run in the Democratic primary, but hasn't ruled out running again as an independent if he's exonerated. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, ISIS-K claims responsibility for Friday's attack on a Russian concert hall that killed at least 137 people. We'll look at how Putin is responding. Stay with us. سكروها بوجه الناس وما عاد حدا يقدر يشوفها بعيون الناس حرقوها هدموها واحتلوا البيوت بعز احجار وياسمين تعربش على الحيطان. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Russia, the death toll has risen to 137 from an attack on a popular concert hall in Moscow Friday. Authorities say gunmen opened fire inside the Crocus City Hall during a sold-out rock concert, then set part of the venue on fire. More than 100 people were also injured, many in critical condition. A survivor described the attack.
They were just walking and shooting as they went along. There were five or six of them. They were just walking and just shooting like this. They did not shoot upwards. They did not scream. They did not say, "Everyone lay down, we will kill you," etc. They were just walking and gunning down everyone methodically in silence. Sound was echoing and we could not understand what was where.
Sunday was a day of mourning in Russia. Authorities have detained 11 people, including four men from Tajikistan, who appeared in court today. They all appeared to have suffered significant injuries, reportedly suffered during interrogations. One suspect was in a wheelchair and seemed to lose consciousness during the court session. Reuters reports he may have had an eye missing. The four are charged with terrorism and face life sentences. An affiliate of the Islamic State, ISIS-K, has claimed responsibility and posted video of the attack online. Russian authorities have suggested Ukraine was in the attack, a claim Kyiv called absurd. The U.S. Embassy had reportedly warned Russia earlier this month that it was, quote, monitoring reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, unquote, especially concert halls. And U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Adrienne Watson said the U.S. government had, quote, shared this information with Russian authorities in accordance with its longstanding duty to warn policy. Putin called the warnings, quote, provocative and outright blackmail in a speech last Tuesday. Today, a Kremlin spokesperson refused to respond to reporters who asked Friday if Friday was an intelligence failure.
Our special services work independently. Any help now is out of the question. Although, as you know, the day before, President Putin had many phone communications, leaders of various countries, Belarus, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkey, and other countries whose leaders spoke with the president over the phone. The intentions to develop and improve cooperation against terrorism were voiced there. The topic was discussed. There are no contacts with the Westerners now.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In a minute, we'll speak with Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School University here in New York. But first, we turn to Joshua Yaffa, contributing writer to The New Yorker magazine, their longtime Moscow correspondent, author of Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition, and Compromise in Putin's Russia. His new piece released yesterday, How Will Putin Respond to the Terrorist Attack in Moscow? Josh, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, how will and how is Putin responding to this attack, as we just listened to Dmitry Peskov, the longtime Kremlin spokesperson?
Well, you highlighted rightly that this is an awkward, to put it mildly, subject for Putin, given the warnings that the West made publicly through that U.S. embassy notice that you read. And there were also clearly private warnings that now the U.S. National Security Council is talking about, in which U.S. shared some intelligence about the prospect or likelihood of an attack. And Putin, at a meeting with high-ranking FSB officials, an address he gave to an FSB colloquium in 3 days before the attack, dismissed those warnings, as you said, as blackmail, as a provocation, as a kind of ruse by the West. So all of this is now, again, to put it mildly and very tragically, quite awkward for Putin, given the scale of the destruction and the terror attack last week. Putin's first instinctual reaction, I think, both with based on political calculation, but also, I think, a kind of genuine, his genuine paranoid read of how things work, was to try and cast a shadow on Ukraine, suggesting that somehow these ISIS-K terrorists had links to Ukraine, that Ukraine and perhaps the West were behind this attack. That fits very much into Putin's paranoid worldview. Of course, it's a very convenient argument and narrative for not just Putin himself, but the Kremlin information machine to the Russian public. We've seen propaganda outlets go into overdrive, state media. Margarita Simonyan, the head of RT, really pushed this narrative that somehow Ukraine must be involved, that even if the perpetrators, the ones who actually carried out the attack, were citizens of Tajikistan, perhaps doing so out of allegiance or in coordination with ISIS-K, that the real villain lies in Ukraine. And I think Putin will continue to try and push this narrative to the extent possible. We saw, as you mentioned, clear signs of torture from the suspects who were brought to Moscow court. Could torture be used to extract a kind of confession, in air quotes, from them that indeed Ukraine or the West stood behind the attack? I think that's possible. We don't know. It's also possible that given how awkward and uncomfortable this is of a subject and how it doesn't actually fit with the larger Kremlin narratives about the war in Ukraine, the necessity of that war, the standoff with the West, the United States as the main enemy, that Putin, the Kremlin, the propaganda machine of the Russian state may try and change the conversation, move on, quickly change topics and actually not devote a lot of attention to this attack and see if they can't get the Russian people to grimly absorb it, as the Russian public has had to grimly absorb so many tragedies in recent years.
I want to go to your reference to what Russian President Vladimir Putin said, suggesting Ukraine was involved in the deadly attacks on Crocus City Hall, vowing to punish all those responsible.
All four of the actual performers of the act of terror, all those who shot and killed people, were found and detained. They tried to hide, and they were moving in the direction of Ukraine. There, according to the preliminary data, they had a crossing of the border prepared from the Ukrainian side. All executors, planners, and those who ordered this crime will be rightfully and inevitably punished, whoever they are and whoever directed them. Let me repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stood behind the terrorists, who prepared this attack against Russia, against our people.
So that's Vladimir Putin. He said that these people, the Tajiks, were headed to the Ukraine border. Talk about who ISIS-K is that claimed responsibility for this attack.
ISIS-K is a group, an affiliate of the larger ISIS, or the ISIS that we came to know in Syria and Iraq. It's based in Central Asia, Afghanistan, where it's most active, and it's engaging in a kind of civil war within the jihadi community with the Taliban, has made Russia a target, at least rhetorically, for some time, citing Russia's own campaign, or the Soviet Union's campaign in Afghanistan against the Mujahideen in the 80s, all the way up to Russia's war against ISIS, its air campaign in Syria, very brutal, destructive, indiscriminate air campaign, a ground campaign involving Wagner mercenaries against ISIS in Palmyra and other sites around Syria, Russia's own repression and ongoing counterinsurgency against Muslim communities, oftentimes Muslim extremist or Muslim militant communities in the Russian North Caucasus. So there's no share of grievance on the side of ISIS-K, again, which doesn't really need to work very hard to try and find or justify targets. It's also in recent months tried to plan attacks in Europe, Germany, elsewhere. Those apparently have been foiled. So the fact that Russia is in ISIS-K's crosshairs is neither nothing new nor particularly all that surprising, given what we know about the group and Russia's own involvement in various interventions in the Muslim world over the years.
I wanted to bring into the conversation with Joshua Yaffa Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, her book titled The Lost Khrushchev, Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, also co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And wanted to get your response as well to this attack. You've talked about it immediately going back to 2004, the Beslan School siege, when Christian rebels, Chechen rebels, rather, occupied a school in the town of Beslan. And whether you think, as Josh was just saying, Putin, whose brand is so-called security, can just hope that this goes away very quickly in the minds of the Russian people.
Well, thank you, Emmy. Putin can hope that it goes away. It doesn't go away. There have been at least three instances already since Friday where various venues, including hospitals, have been warning, bomb warnings, and they've been evacuated. So that seems to be going on, even if there is no bombing and perhaps there are false warnings. It is really to destabilize this Putin's claim that Russia is stable. And of course, when we talk about Putin's or Russia's state dealings with the Islamic fundamentalists, it goes back even to 2002 when a theater during the performance of Nordost was attacked. And then, of course, Beslan School is 2006. Then there have been a study done that from 1995 to 2006, I mean, it's not a clear number, but approximate number, about 20,000 people have been killed in those attacks by Islamic fundamentalists. Then, of course, there's other instances, the 2011, the 2007, the 2017, all in subways or other places in Russia. And also, that is the first time when Russia dealt with ISIS, with ISIS-K, with this group that attacked on Friday was in 2022, where the Russian embassy in Kabul was bombed and two people were killed then. So really, there's been more than one or two. There've been over 10 or even 20 instances of Putin's or Russia's dealing with it. And in his performance, in his sort of response to the attack, when he spoke for about 6 minutes after the attack on Saturday, today, he spoke about the Nazis, because that's the important message that he needs to deliver, since his whole point in Ukraine is denazification of Ukraine. So he needed to make this kind of connection, while in truth, of course, he should have been talking about the kind of Muslim treatment in Russia and the Islamic fundamentalist threat that is not just in Russia, but all over. And that's unfortunate, because Russia seems to be denying global cooperation, and that will create more problems, not just for the world, but for Russia, inside Russia, for sure.
Now, just to say, ISIS-K has targeted the United States, but the United States has left Afghanistan. They've targeted Pakistan, repeatedly targeted China, as well as Russia. The significance of these are different lines than we traditionally see. You know, you're either attacking Russia or the United States. We see it very much as an east-west line. ISIS-K doesn't.
Exactly. It doesn't. And that's why when Peskov says we have no cooperation with the West, that's unfortunate, because